Good to be here. Again, my name is Walt. I'm used to getting sort of a back and forth, so hopefully later we'll have some of that. I'll start out by introducing a topic that I really like, which is around craving. But I thought, trying to figure out, because I don't know most of you, I'm just trying to figure out where's a good place to start so that I can sort of introduce myself in some fashion. Part of my story is that I'm a recovering alcoholic addict. When I spent my teen years kind of struggling with those issues, and then ended up in a 28-day treatment center as part of my college graduation package, learned a lot in that time period, and ended up kind of, in a way, forced onto a spiritual path that I may or may not have ended up on otherwise. So in a way, I'm very grateful for all that. It's funny, I loved the film Lady Bird, and which I know was filmed partially here, and it's a great ode to Sacramento. And Diane took me around, and we saw some of the things featured in the movie here, which was fun tonight before coming here. So that was great. Little movie tourism in Sacramento. And so I'm kind of a movie buff, I should mention. And anyway, so I ended up on a spiritual path. I'd always, even in high school, I was interested in meditation. I had a pamphlet of Transcendental Meditation, TM. It was with a picture of Maharaji Mahesh Yogi on it, and I made up my own mantra and would sit in my room and try to meditate, figure out. And there was a breakthrough moment during that period that I have never forgotten. I was always in conflict with my father at that time because I was basically sneaking around smoking pot and drinking, and he was trying to police the situation as best he could, which is hard with sneaky teenagers. I'm afraid I have a daughter now, and I have no idea what I'm in for. So I really kind of thought I hated my father at this certain time I was like 16 or something. And I went and I meditated as best I could, and there was a moment where I kind of dropped below the kind of rage I had and got reconnected with, you know, the love that I had for my father. And I really realized, oh, I still love him. I'm just pissed off, you know. But I really saw it clearly for that moment. And it was a real revelation at the time. You might call it an insight. And so then I remember I went downstairs. I said, well, I feel great up here alone in my room. Let's check this out. So I remember going downstairs, and he was watching a football game Sunday afternoon or something, and just sat next to him on the couch. He didn't even talk to me, but I just noticed, yeah, I still feel the same way. He's my father. I love him, you know, and the rage has dissipated, at least for the moment. But I didn't keep meditating at that time because nobody else was doing it, and tried to recruit friends, and it was not a popular thing to do. So I kind of didn't do it for a while, but then after I'd been in recovery for a while, I met a woman who had an art gallery in Berkeley, and we kind of hit it off just as friends talking about art. And then one day she said, oh, I need to take you to hear Jack Kornfield speak at this place called Spirit Rock, which sounded a little woo-woo to me at the time. But I liked the name Jack Kornfield, I think because it was like Jack Kerouac, who I liked. I'd never heard of Jack Kornfield at the time. This is like 1993. But anyway, so I went and saw Jack with her, and I have a lot of gratitude for her. Her name's Cecile. Because, yeah, just as soon as I was introduced to whatever Jack Kornfield was offering, it really spoke to me at the time and still does. Not just Jack, but, you know, through him, I was introduced to the insight meditation tradition, which I don't think I'd ever even heard of before. And then, you know, I worked for Spirit Rock for 7 years. I went through their community Dharma Leaders training program. So they've gotten a lot from Spirit Rock over the years. And so that's just to give you some background. And then just to cut to the chase, then I went through a divorce. And so I had been dabbling in this insight meditation stuff, and it helped me a lot. But I was still, you know, living a regular life, shall we say, with more of a workaholic than anything else. And but then I went through this divorce, and I got laid off from my job. And suddenly I started to really be looking for some relief. I was like, I should be happier than I am in this life right now. I'm doing something wrong. And I went on my first retreat at that period. And it was at Spirit Rock, and it was just a 5-day men's retreat. But it kind of changed my life in a way, because I really felt like this was what I've been looking for. And it was kind of like I'd been waiting my whole life to do this. And then I went on another 10-day retreat right after that one. I got in I was like number 72 on the waiting list. It was not looking good. And then 2 days before the retreat, they called and said, "We have a spot. Do you want it?" And because I'd been laid off, sort of a blessing in disguise, I had the time to do it. So anyway, that really was the beginning, I think, of my, you know, practice. I call it going pro when we start going on retreats, which is a bit of a luxury, I realize, because just have the time to do it, not to mention the resources. But if, you know, there are a lot of scholarships and things to help people go, and having worked at Spirit Rock, I know that, you know, I always encourage people, just apply for the scholarship, don't worry about it. they're not checking tax returns. Anyway, that's just to give you a bit of background. And then another key thing is I met Kevin Griffin, who some of you may know, who wrote the book One Breath at a Time, Buddhism and the 12 Steps. And so through him, I was able to, I'd already been having a lot of these thoughts about how the spiritual principles that I was learning from the 12-step program and what I was learning in Buddhism, it just seemed to all mesh. It seemed to have a lot of common ground. And so Kevin, I was in the East Bay, and Kevin had a group at the time, so I would go. I remember I would, you know, attend his group and then afterwards start talking to him. And then 2 hours later, we would still be standing in the parking lot talking about this stuff. So somehow that was a fun time, and it really, and then that was somewhere in there I decided I would like to in a way follow in Kevin's footsteps and help other recovering people get the benefits of this practice, because it just really helped me. It was like I was pretty happy in recovery. But then adding the more serious Buddhist practice, I felt really, it was like somebody said, call off the search. It was like I was no longer searching for something. And I definitely was a seeker, you know, my whole life up until then. And it's funny, I think it was yesterday, I got some spam email and it said, change your life, you know, and I can remember a time where I would have been so quick to click on that to see what that was all about. And it was just an interesting checkpoint. It was like, I'm totally happy with my life. Like, I had no even inkling of like, oh, I need to click on that to see what they're talking about. I deleted it, you know, immediately. But it was just kind of an interesting thing. It's like, no, I'm actually at a point where I'm not looking for anything else, you know. So, really grateful to, you know, not that everything's perfect, but I feel like I've found whatever I was looking for, which in a way leads us to our topic of the night, which I called the destruction of craving, based on a phrase from the Dhammapada. I didn't just make it up. And I used to use the end of craving, but I saw somebody else is offering a workshop at Napa Insight called the end of craving. So I dropped that. Now I'm using the destruction of craving, which is more exciting anyway. So I love, it all started in a way, I love the passage from the Dhammapada that I'll read it real. Joseph Goldstein reads this pretty, refers to this, house builder, you are seen. You will not build a house again. All the rafters are broken, the ridge pole destroyed. The mind gone to the unconstructed has reached the end of craving. And there's lots of exclamation marks in there. But in that, I always was led to believe that was supposedly right after the Buddha's enlightenment, he wrote this poem, and that was what it was. And then, unfortunately, I talked to scholar Gil Fronsdale, who Diane mentioned, and he says, well, actually, that's referenced in another sutta and attributed to somebody else, so now we don't know who said that. So, but it doesn't really matter, because it's not about who said it as much as what it says. What is fascinating to me, being somebody, I guess, who works with craving and constantly being somebody in recovery, is that this idea that when the Buddha had achieved his great awakening, he described it as the end of craving, the end of craving. And so for me, that's been kind of a mantra. What would that even look like? Because, what is he really pointing to here? What is that? And why was that emphasized in that so pretty dramatic way with an exclamation mark? So that's been kind of a, it's been an ongoing investigation for me. It's also, most of you I'm sure are familiar with the Four Noble Truths. First Noble Truth, there is the arising of suffering, there is suffering. The second noble truth is there is a cause of suffering, and that is craving. I'm not going to get into all the nuances of these, but so the cause of the suffering is craving. It's kind of a basic equation of the Four Noble Truths. And then the third one is that there is, the end of suffering is the letting go of craving. So, and then the fourth is the path, the Noble Eightfold Path that leads to the end of craving. So there's some work involved in this end of craving stuff, which is kind of too bad, but anyway, and then for the topic tonight, they asked me to choose this a couple months ago, and I came up with the topic and decided to make a practice of reading. There's a whole chapter in the Dhammapada on craving. So I decided to make it a practice of reading just that chapter every day for the past month and a week or something. So just as a, I saw a talk by Bhikkhu Bodhi where he took a short passage from the Dhammapada and talked about this one short passage and said, it's not a bad idea to pick something that resonates with you and just make it your practice to read it every day for a while and just ponder it. So I chose this topic, this chapter on craving. I had thought maybe I'll read the whole chapter, but then I think that would just be a lot of reading at this point. So I'm not going to do that, but it turns out some of my favorite passages are in this chapter, so I'll share some of it with you. What is that? Just to give you a flavor of it, it starts out, the craving of a person who lives negligently or heedlessly spreads like a creeping vine. Such a person leaps ever onward like a monkey seeking fruit in the forest. Sorrow grows like grass after rain for anyone overcome by this miserable craving and clinging to the world. Sorrow falls away like drops of water from a lotus for anyone who overcomes this miserable craving and clinging to the world. That's how it opens. And by the way, this is Gil Fronsdale's translation, which I think is excellent. There are many translations. It's worth looking at. I looked at a lot of them. This is still my favorite. So there, it keeps going. It does say, the next passage I like, it says, "This I say to you, good fortune to all assembled here." It's like a Shakespeare play or something. "Dig out the root of craving as you would the fragrant root of Birana grass. Don't let Mara destroy you again and again as a torrential river breaks a reed." And Mara is kind of like the devil or the tempter. I'm fascinated by Mara, but that's a different talk. Yeah, it's been a really nice practice to just read through this every day and just ponder it. Let's see. I'll get back to it in a minute, but I wanted to talk more. I have some notes. One thing is, so we talk about this word craving in English. The word in Pali, P-A-L-I, an ancient Indian language that they say is as close to what the Buddha would have spoken as we still have available. Anyway, the word that we're talking about is tanha, T-A-N-H-A, and the sort of literal definition is the fever of unsatisfied longing or thirst. And I really like those definitions because it gives you such a visceral feeling. It's either a fever or a thirst. So when we're caught in with this tanha, it's, you know, we're really caught. And they also call it the net of craving. You get caught in the net of craving. Or in the Dhammapada, it's I think referred to, it's kind of like a spider caught in his own web, something like that. So I mean, the word craving works pretty well, but I love the fever of unsatisfied longing, because I kind of felt like that's what I was suffering from most of my life until a certain point. One reason I love the film Lady Bird is she seems to have like this really craving to change her circumstances, and I can relate to that. Now there can be, you know, there are positive aspirations we can have for ourselves, that this is not talking about that per se. It's more things that are, when we're caught in a craving for either sensual pleasure, or this is the traditional version, or what's called becoming or non-becoming. This is one of the traditional definitions from the Four Noble Truths teaching. And so it's the sensual pleasure one is pretty self-evident. We probably all deal with that in different ways. And then the becoming could probably be understood in many ways, but it's kind of like we're always wanting to become something. It's kind of like in the future I will be a great writer and everybody's going to, you know, love me, or in the future, we want to be something, I guess, that we're not. We're not content with where we are. And, you know, it can happen in many ways. It's a subtle, I think that one is really interesting. And then the non-becoming is kind of the could be a suicidal feeling or just a feeling of wanting out in some way, is how I see it. And so, but the one, the sensual desire one is kind of the the one that we're, it probably is what we're used to thinking in terms of craving. So one of my favorite teachers is Sayadaw Utejan Nia from Burma or Myanmar, and I've had the opportunity to practice with him a few times. He emphasizes this. He talks about greed a lot too, and I think he's talking about the same thing. But here, this is a quote from his book Dhamma Everywhere. He says, "Craving is very tricky. It's always pushing you. Whatever you think, whatever you say, whatever you do, craving is pushing you, motivating you. There are many ways for craving to come in or arise in your mind. What do you want? Sometimes you should ask yourself, what do I want? Do I want something? There's always wanting. Because of this wanting, desire, craving, expectation, the mind is suffering, tense, and dissatisfied." And then he says, if the mind doesn't want anything, it is free. And I like that. I think it's the same thing the Buddha, the Dhammapada is pointing to, but sometimes hearing it just put in a different voice can be helpful. And I find his voice, the way he puts things, very helpful and useful. I spent some time at his monastery in outside of Yangon a few years ago. It was very interesting practicing there. And the main thing I noticed was the greed, I guess because he kept talking about it, but I just noticed exactly what he just said there, that there was always this wanting or greed in my mind of like wanting lunch or, you know, wanting to go talk to somebody or wanting to escape the monastery and go back to Yangon or whatever it was, wanting a more comfortable bed. but that actually, as I could see it clearly, I could kind of let it go pretty easily. I just really kept working with that, seeing it and letting it go. And I'll have to say that one of the happiest times of my life was probably spending time at that monastery. And it was really an interesting experience because all my usual luxuries were gone. And I had to wear a longi, which I was not used to, which was, you know, it's like a long piece of cloth that you just wrap around your waist. And it took a couple days, and still getting up and down steps was tricky. But by the end of it, I didn't want to stop wearing it. I got really used to it. It was kind of a funny thing to go from not sure I want to have to wear this thing to, oh, it's a bummer, I don't think I can keep wearing this when I get back to Berkeley. I really worked with that. And I do have a story that I tell that I think illustrates this wanting and working with craving pretty well. So near the end of my time at the monastery, you know, one thing is I chose the time I went because I knew that Sayadaw was supposed to be there. Sayadaw just means teacher in Burmese or something to that effect. And that's what everybody calls Sayadaw Utejan Nia when you're there. So anyway, he would do these English groups where he'd meet with us in small groups. He's also kind of quirky, so he would schedule you and then just get a better offer or something and leave the monastery suddenly. And then they just wipe, you know, your group was on the board and all of a sudden somebody would just wipe it off the board and you're like, oh no. So you really got to work with that in your mind because it was like, you looked forward to these meetings. And I was getting ready to leave in the next few days and there was nothing scheduled. You know, so I didn't know if I was going to get to see him again at all in one of these groups. And it was definitely on my mind a lot. And, you know, it was kind of like, by all rights, we should have had a group yesterday. Why didn't we, you know? Like, but you really weren't supposed to go complain to anybody, as far as I could tell. It's kind of like you just accept things as they are. We're all trying to be like enlightened Buddhists or something. But I noticed, I went back to my room in the afternoon, and I realized I was pretty agitated, like worked up about, like, I really want to see him again. I came all this way, you know. It's just so, the proliferating mind was really in effect. And at some point, oh, and I know they had these bumper stickers everywhere that just said, be mindful in English and then also in Burmese. And they were kind of plastered all over the monastery, which I thought was interesting. But, and I, of course, right at this moment, I'm sitting there pretty agitated, and I look at the door and see, be mindful. And my first thought was, no, but they don't mean this, you know. You know, this is a serious problem. And of course, fortunately, I had just enough practice under my belt to catch that and realize, oh no, they absolutely mean this. This is what we're talking about. This is really the craving. And it was amazing to just really see it and name it. And it's funny how there's sort of the craving that we're perfectly willing to look at, and then there's always some subtle one, and this is what Seidel is always pointing to, that we don't actually want to see. We kind of want to leave it. But so in that moment, I really saw it. And it was great as I just kind of sat with it. And after a few minutes, it kind of cleared up, and I just kind of accepted, well, if I don't see him, I've still had a great time being here. It's not like there's a real problem. It's like we just create these problems in our minds with this wanting, you know. And so I really was able to let it go. And I walked outside a few minutes later, and here comes Sayadaw walking up the road. He's coming back from some trip or whatever. And a woman from my group, and this is not to, but you know, what is it, for the grace of God go I or whatever. She was clearly agitated about not getting to see him. And she went right up to him and started giving him a piece of her mind. And I just remember thinking, yeah, that could have so easily been me. But instead, I'm like, I feel fine. And so that's just an illustration. We did actually have a group again with him before I left, just to just in case you were wondering. But it was the best, probably the biggest teaching I got. And that, for me, was about what I'm trying to point to here is the how the craving kind of operates sometimes and how subtle it can be. One thing Seidel does a lot, well, he has a great story where he was starting to lead a retreat somewhere, I think it was Singapore, and it was a group of yogis, and they were very dedicated yogis, you know, practitioners, sitting in front of him, and he starts talking about this topic, and he can kind of tell that they feel like this is a bit beneath them, or that they're really not caught in craving. They're strong practitioners. And he says, but think about it. Aren't you wanting to have a good retreat while you're here? And it was kind of like everybody in the room went, oh, yeah, of course. So it was that, too, that we're always wanting, you know, wanting this moment to be good in some different way or wanting it to stop. So craving can be, you know, for something or wanting something to go away. And there's, I brought a lot of notes, but so there's some science that talks about this now that is very interesting to me. I feel like science is catching up with the Buddha 2,500 years later. And one scientist in particular that jumped out at me is Dr. Kent Berridge, who you may or may not have heard of. I don't think he's that well known. But he did some work. It was on rats in a lab around... But he was looking at the brain, and maybe I'm going to read a little from an article in a magazine called Intelligent Life by Amy Fleming. She says, as Aristotle once wrote, it is of the nature of desire not to be satisfied, and most men live only for the gratification of it. And then she says, Buddhists, meanwhile, have endeavored for 2,500 years to overcome the suffering caused by our propensity for longing. Now it seems Dr. Kent Berridge has found the neuroanatomical basis for this facet of the human condition, that we are hardwired to be insatiable wanting machines. If you had opened a textbook on brain rewards in the late 1980s, it would have told you that the dopamine and opioids that swished and flickered around the reward pathway were the blissful brain chemicals responsible for pleasure. The reward system was about pleasure and somehow learning what yields it, and little more. So when Berridge, a dedicated young scientist who was more David than Goliath, stumbled upon evidence in 1986 that dopamine did not produce pleasure, but in fact desire, he kept quiet. It wasn't until the early 1990s, after rigorous research, that he felt bold enough to go public with his new thesis. The reward system, he then asserted, has two distinct elements, wanting and liking, or desire and pleasure. While dopamine makes us want, the liking part comes from opioids and also endocannabinoids, which paint a gloss of pleasure, as Berridge puts it, on good experiences. For years, this thesis was contested, and only now is it gaining mainstream acceptance. So anyway, I just find this fascinating. First of all, the wanting and liking, I think, is an interesting distinction. And the fact that, as she says, we are hardwired to be insatiably wanting machines, I think it's, for me, that's been really helpful to look at. And of course, you don't have to believe this, but you might check it out for yourself, see how it works in your system. And then she goes on to say, Berridge's most telling discovery was that whereas the dopamine wanting system is vast and powerful, the pleasure circuit is anatomically tiny, has a far more fragile structure, and is harder to trigger. So basically the wanting, the brain is really wired for the wanting, but the liking is actually pretty, a lot less goes into it, and it's very easily disrupted. And I find this really interesting. So we're actually very unlikely to get that much satisfaction out of the liking part of it. It's that we're really wired for the wanting. And this was an evolutionary thing to keep us doing what we need to do to get food and, partners to keep the species going. But do we still want to be trapped by that today is the question. And it seems as though the Buddha saw how this was operating 2,500 years ago and tried to point it out to us. And, I mean, fortunately, we still have his teachings to look at. And I've found them really helpful in working with this system, which is, in a weird way, kind of out of balance. And he's offering a way where we don't have to be caught by this anymore in the same way. And I just find it really helpful to think about it in this way, that, oh yeah, of course I'm caught in wanting. There's a story from my childhood that my wife teases me about, where I had a favorite place to go as a kid. I grew up in Virginia, and there was a place called Goshen Pass that I loved, and had these big boulders up a river, and my favorite activity was to jump from boulder to boulder to boulder to boulder up the river, right? I don't know why, it felt like I was flying or something, and I just that made me happy. And one day I was with my family at this cabin, and it was a slightly rainy-ish day. I had cabin fever, and I wanted to go to Goshen. And my parents were said, no, it's going to rain later today, and it's not a good day to go to Goshen. We're not going there. But I just kept saying, Goshen, Goshen, Goshen. I want to go to Goshen, Goshen. And after, like, I don't know how long, my parents finally said, okay, get in the car. We're going to Goshen. They absolutely didn't want to go, but I wouldn't take no for an answer, and then I went. And I don't really even remember the actual getting to the, you know, being at Goshen. I just remember being so caught in the solution to my problem today is I have to go to this place. But so my wife occasionally just says, Goshen, Goshen, Goshen. and I know exactly what she means, and I like... So you might just look at that in your own life and see if there's a Goshen Goshen that you get caught by. So I hope that, I guess we're running kind of low on time. I'm going to end in 10 minutes. Hopefully this is helpful. I mean, there's a lot more that one could say. And just trying to, of course, I had many notes. I don't want to forget something too important. I was listening to a talk by Joseph Goldstein recently, and he was saying that this craving, it's considered a hindrance to our meditation, too. It blocks us from concentration or samadhi and, cultivating ease and relaxation and one-pointed focus. I mean, we might have one-pointed focus, but it's on sort of a negative object, you might say. So that was helpful to think of it that way. And then, of course, the in the chain of dependent origination, which is one of the key teachings in Buddhism, craving is on the list, and it goes, part of the list is contact, sense contact, feeling, meaning pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant, and then craving. And so if we deem something pleasant, then craving usually kicks in, and then once we get caught in craving, then it goes to grasping or attachment, and we're kind of off to the races. And the perpetual cycle of samsara or suffering is, we stay on that wheel. But it's often said that if the one point on the chain that you can break is at the feeling tone, vedana in the Pali language, V-E-D-A-N-A, and that's the pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. And that's been a really interesting place for me to bring my mindfulness practice, especially on retreat, just noticing how that operates. That can be very helpful in your daily life once you cultivate it, because then you're not at the mercy of whether something's pleasant or unpleasant. Because often we just automatically react. I have a one-year-old daughter. I can tell you, we're kind of hardwired that way. If she doesn't like, she hates having her face wiped. You give her some black bean and refried black beans. For some reason, we like to give her that, and she gets it all over her whole face. Because she kind of like, you put it in her mouth, and then she takes her hand and does this, and then she starts going like this in there. And then, of course, you have to wipe her face off, but she hates the feeling of having her face wiped off and screams, And I always want to say, it's just unpleasant vedana. It does not work with her. However, we can be very reactive that way if we don't have, like, a practice of seeing it for what it is and not getting... That does bring us to something in the Dhammapada that I like, where, let's see, because I was going to read more of this. Let's see, it says, but for people who have agitated thoughts and intense passion and who are focused on what's pleasant, craving grows more and more. Indeed, they strengthen their bonds. But those who delight in calming their mind, their thoughts, are always mindful and cultivate a focus on what's unpleasant will bring an end to craving. They will cut Mara's bonds. And the focusing on what's unpleasant, that's according to the footnote, it's a comment on asubha practice, which is the sort of the 32 parts of the body. We can be very focused on, you know, bodies in the human realm. And it's one, the monastics use this because they have a vow of chastity. So they start to see everything as hair, nails, teeth, and skin, that kind of thing, rather than being attracted to somebody. Or they just say, oh, it's just hair, nails, teeth, and skin. And then that helps them be disenchanted and dispassionate from that object. And it can be useful if you're, you know, trying to meditate or stay celibate. So that's what they're kind of pointing to there. But for me, what I try to work with is, you know, noticing unpleasant and noticing how I respond to it. I didn't really talk about the prison work, but I recently went to a jail to visit somebody that I was sort of asked to go see periodically. And, you know, they really can give you the runaround at these institutions sometimes. And it was just a classic situation where I had to wait. I came at the appointed time, thought somebody was meeting me in the lobby to escort me in. They never showed up. And then we tried to call him. Nobody answered. And then I finally found out he wasn't even there. He was at a different facility that day. And I was like, what? I thought he was going to meet me. And then somebody else, a Catholic priest, showed up. And he didn't know anything about it, but he sort of said he would take me in. And then so eventually I finally got in, and I was sort of one step away from meeting with the person. And then he came and said, a fight just broke out. And everything's locked down for the rest of the day because they'll have to write a report and all this stuff. So I'm sorry, you won't be able to see him today. It was like, after all that, this is several hours of like rigmarole, and then, you know, absolutely nothing. And so you could easily get into a negative reaction, or you could just say, well, that's how it goes sometimes. And now I get to go home and see my wife and baby again, you know. So I was able in that moment to be equanimous. And it was kind of, for me, that's the end of craving right there, that you just meet circumstances with that, you know, if I were really craving that moment to be different, then I'd be caught in reactivity and chew somebody out, but where is that really going to get me? Because the fight happened on the yard, and they're not going to let me in. And so, just an interesting moment. Well, I've probably talked enough. I did want to end on this part of the Dhammapada from the craving chapter. Two things we'll end it. I'll just end with this. The gift of Dharma surpasses all gifts. The taste of Dharma surpasses all tastes. The delight in Dharma surpasses all delights. The destruction of craving conquers all suffering. Thank you. And I guess we have just a couple minutes if anybody had a question or comment before we close, just to check in with you. I meant to have more time for interaction, but I got talking too much. Did that... anything anybody want to ask? Yes.
I really don't know much about Buddhism. I'm just kind of learning. And the thing that's puzzling to me is I think of passion as a craving. So what happens to art and medicine and technology that lifts people and saves people? And, you know, the people that produce that are very passionate and, I presume, crave results and maybe fame or whatever.
Right. Well, I think that I mean, if you're in it to be famous, then that would be the craving part that's not helpful. But if you're in it to help mankind, then that's a positive aspiration, and that would be considered wholesome and positive. So yeah, there's a wholesome version of desire called chanda in Pali, and that's not a problem at all. We're talking about what's called tanha, which is this craving where we're caught in the fever of unsatisfied longing, which is sort of an agitated state. But it's a great question. I do think about the difference a lot, and I also create art, and I haven't found that my practice takes away from that, that passion. I was just taking pictures of Club Raven sign, the neon sign earlier. I think that that's a great question, but there is a differentiation there that's important. And there's aspiration and there's expectation. Joseph Goldstein talked about that in a talk I just listened to. The expectation is what is a hindrance to our practice. But aspiration is, we aspire to, for liberation is not a problem. It gets us here practicing, gets us to the cushion. Thank you. Anything else before we close? Shall we yes?
Do you ever think of how this craving works so well for the advertising agencies? So they can get us craving with the desire, and then the sad thing that goes along with all that buying is the CO2 emissions and the global warming.
Absolutely, there's that, and the tech companies are using it against us. They know, like when you get the little notification that you have an email or a text or whatever, you get a dopamine hit off of that, and that keeps you craving more. It's like, what else can I do on my phone now? So yeah, it's used against us a lot. I meant to talk about that too more. So this is a big topic, thanks for bringing that in. I guess that means it's time to close. So let's just dedicate the merit if we could. Just pausing briefly before we end, coming back to ourselves, taking a few mindful breaths. May any merit that arises from our practice together tonight be for the benefit of all beings everywhere. May all beings, including ourselves, be happy, peaceful, and free. Thank you.